I'm interested in Black history, but I think the most compelling commitment we can make to Black history is an investment in Black future.
Welcome to Colors of Recovery, a monthly podcast brought to you by the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers, where we cover topics related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and elevate diverse voices of professionals in our field.
Hi, I'm Zena Rodriguez. I'm a mental wellness advocate, and I'm a diversity, equity, and inclusion champion.
And I'm Tanya Bhattacharya, and I know personally that stories have power. Zena and I met 12 years ago at our first NAACP conference, where we were the only two women of color at the table. 12 years later, not much is different. We're here to change that. Zena and I are here with Phil Rutherford, who's the Chief Operating Officer at Faces and Voices of Recovery. He's a recovery coach, a passionate member of the recovery community, and has a BA in psychology with a specialization in substance use disorders. And we also want to celebrate and honor the fact he is the first African-American board member of NAATP. Phil, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, you're welcome. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you guys.
So Phil, let's get right into it. Tell me a little bit about your experience working in this field as a person of color.
Well, it's been an interesting experience. My own personal recovery journey has brought me through a number of experiences. And as a person of color, I think one of the first things that is apparent, especially in the 12-step pathways, is that kind of right away, I noticed that there weren't a lot of people that looked like me in 12-step rooms. And part of that is geographically based, right? I'm sure if I'd attempted recovery in areas that were densely populated with people that of color, it might've been different. But my experience started in South Florida, where there really just weren't a lot of people that looked like me. And I think one of the things that happens in 12-step recovery specifically is that you're told, hey, you know, focus on the similarities, not the differences. And I needed that. And I honor that. That helped me to kind of get past some of the things. But as time continued and as my recovery journey continued and I was able to get some stability, I did notice that there were some differences. There were some differences in my, even in the way that I got to recovery, some of my experiences with law enforcement and just the way that the world viewed me and the way that I experienced life in general was dramatically different than some of my counterparts in recovery.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I have a quick follow-up question to that before Zena asks her question, which is, can you share an aha moment from working in this field?
An aha moment. I think obviously we're talking, I mean, we're in the frame of matters of culture, right? And I think the aha moment that I had probably over the past year or so is that when we're talking about recovery, there's a saying that, you know, we focus on the things that we have in common and we focus on we stick to recovery, and that is absolutely valid, right? But focusing on recovery in and of itself is a matter of privilege. I can't separate all of the layers of my identity only from recovery. And I think my moment surrounded this notion that recovery was somehow unique and that I could somehow set aside my experience with the criminal justice system or my experience with feeling like, or wondering if I'm going to die every time I'm pulled over by law enforcement from my, all of that is kind of mushed together. I don't have an opportunity to parse those things out. Whereas some of my counterparts in recovery could simply walk in a room and say, yeah, I'm just going to focus on recovery. And it's not a, oh, poor Phil moment, but it was kind of a moment of clarity where I was like, okay, sometimes when I'm talking about things like recovery, I need to understand and be cognizant of the fact that not everyone sees it the same way.
This is Zena here. I really appreciate what you're saying there. And when we look at it through that lens, when we transition that into a person of recovery and then a a person of color in recovery working in the field, you're the first African-American board member of NAACP. What makes the work that we're doing now so important?
Well, first and foremost, recovery is a health issue, right? It's not, I mean, yes, we're doing special work, and the business of recovery being a biopsychosocial spiritual construct is 100% true. It's also a health issue, and we cannot kind of stick our heads in the sand and ignore the health disparities that exist. And if we want to actually deliver true health equity to the community, then we have to look at recovery through this lens, and we have to examine the glaring disparities in the way people of color receive substance use disorder treatment. And when I say glaring, I mean glaring. The numbers are ugly.
Yeah, definitely agreed.
So the field and many other fields in our country are grappling with the work of DEI. So I'm just curious, Phil, what are the challenges and the barriers that you're seeing?
Well, DEI is certainly the, you know, there are lots of buzzwords that have come out of 2020, COVID being one of them, pandemic. But DEI is certainly a close second or third to that. And, you know, when I think of DEI, and I didn't come up with this on my own, but when I think of diversity, I think of facts and you know, numbers of things, right? So I've got in a bowl, I've got 12 red marbles, 3 green marbles, and 4 purple marbles. That's diversity. And that in and of itself doesn't really do a lot for culture. And when I think of inclusion is a behavior, and it's a deliberate behavior. And when I think of inclusion, I think of acts, overt acts that people are doing. And then when I think of equity, that's an investment. So the reason I'm talking about these things is there has been a lot of discussion about DEI, but I'm not sure that that has always lined up with those concepts that I just described. I think in general, people understand the idea of having people that look different involved in corporate culture, treatment culture, nonprofit culture. I think that's actually I shouldn't say it's an easy thing to do because it wasn't always true, but I think people have largely gotten over that hurdle. The next hurdle of inclusion, of intentionally including people that look different and have different backgrounds, not just about race, but about gender and pathways to recovery, including those people in the discussion, the deliberate act of including those people in the discussion is coming along, but I wouldn't say we're there yet. And then the kind of the big kahuna equity of investment, of people actually signing on the dotted line and saying, I'm going to invest X number of dollars in this project with these specific metrics to be measured over this period of time. I think that's where the rubber hits the road.
Are you interested in learning more about becoming a member of NAATP? NAATP offers an array of membership benefits and services that will increase exposure for your facility, provide tools and resources to educate your staff, and allow you to be part of an outstanding network of behavioral health and addiction treatment professionals. For more information, please go to www.naatp.org/membership. Or click on the link in our show notes.
Mark your calendars for December 7th through 9th, 2021, and join us for the 42nd Annual National Addiction Leadership Conference in Denver, Colorado. NAATP National is the leading educational and networking event geared towards leaders and decision makers within the addiction treatment industry. Visit naatp.org/conference to learn more about registration, exhibiting, and sponsoring this much anticipated event.
So Phil, can you share some of the experiences within your own organization as they've gone through this journey?
Sure. And I think we're pretty open about some of the things that have happened. And over the I've been at Faces and Voices going on about 4 years now. And I think sort of the history of the organization, I mean, Faces and Voices started as a result of a forum that happened in 2001, which, by the way, we're having an anniversary party in St. Paul in October of this year. So that's my plug for that event. But as a result of that, Faces and Voices has been around a long time. And I think even talking to some of the people that were a part of that initial meeting, Bill White and Joe Powell, and some of those guys that have been doing it, Tom Hill, some of those guys have been doing this a long time. The initial concepts were there to sort of tackle diversity, equity, and inclusion. And somewhere along the way, that path got sacrificed. So subsequently over the years, there were some sort of I won't say feeble attempts, but there were some sort of glancing attempts at doing that, but not really a lot of execution, and some complaints from the community about it, to Faces and Voices. And this sort of culminated in an event that happened with us in April of last year, where there was an event that was going to happen regarding COVID, and the community was not happy with the way that we handled it. And it really kind of forced us to take a look at it. And it actually forced me as a Black man to look at my role in the organization and kind of what we were doing specifically around Black and Indigenous people of color and what our commitment to recovery was there. As a COO, a lot of times, I'm a money guy, right? And I, it's not that we work in the shadows, but a lot of times the things that we're doing are not super public facing, but I reached a point where I felt like I needed to speak up and speak out. And as a result of that, we headed down a path, we brought in a consultant, and, it was very timely, right? Because I said April of last year, this is prior to the George Floyd incident. And that didn't hurt the effort, because it kind of placed our effort on steroids, but we'd sort of started down that path. And truth be told, when I was brought on, I kind of started noticing some things about the way that the organization operated that, did not support equity in the way that I thought it should. So subsequent to that, we have, and I guess there are probably people in the recovery area that might suggest that we've gone too far the other direction. This month we'll be having our fourth of what we call DEI forums, where we invite the community to come and basically share what they're seeing in their communities. This one in particular, because it's Black History Month, we're talking about the recovery legacies of Frederick Douglass and Malcolm X. And I think that, for as it pertains to our direction, I think that we have definitely turned the ship toward recovery equity and social justice as it pertains to recovery. And I think just social justice in general, we've certainly done I don't know if about face is the right term, but we've certainly had a course correction.
So Phil, on this Colors of Recovery podcast, we do call the thing. And Phil, I really want to know, in your opinion, what are the barriers that hold individuals and organizations back from truly embodying DEI initiatives and making true shift?
Calling the thing, I think fragility, I think, is one of the things, right? Like, so sort of the discomfort with calling out racism and actually doing anti-racist things. That is the thing, right? So one of the things that holds organizations back is, and I do some cultural competency work, and sometimes I have to get people over this notion of saying, hey, this behavior is racist. And it does not mean that you are going to burn in hell as a result of this behavior. But if we can't openly and clearly identify practices and things that have been done as racist or harmful to a particular group, we can't get anywhere. We can't change anything. If we can't say we had a practice or a policy that was harmful to a specific group of people, and we know it, and we're going to do something to change it, then that community, when they look at the organization, they know, right? Like it's kind of, I have these conversations with people where they'll say something and they'll be dancing around the subject and I'll be like, hey, you know what? I've been Black my whole life. Like I know what racism looks like. And so I think calling the thing is a very important component. So the things that block it are fragility and this, James Baldwin talks about the lie, but there is a very American tradition of denying the facts that are staring us in the face. It is clear that systemic racism is a component in the healthcare system. It's never been more clear. COVID, if it wasn't clear before, COVID has peeled back the scab and made that 100% clear. So that's clear. We know it's present. The question isn't, is it there or not? The question is, what are we going to do about it?
Thanks for that, Phil. I think that's really a good segue into, we know this is, we have this pandemic going on, and this has become such a huge issue for our communities. What resources do you know of are currently available, and maybe some initiatives that you've been working on with some other organizations?
Well, we are a part of there are a group of, specifically in recovery world, there are a group of organizations, ourselves, Young People in Recovery, Association of Recovery Schools, White Bison. After sort of all of this happened, the event in April, we got together and decided to work on what we could do differently. And I can't, the document is not ready yet, but we're working on something called the Recovery North Star. And I won't go into details about, if you want to know about the North Star, it's a paper that Frederick Douglass published. It's there's all kinds of symbolism in the concept of the North Star, but it really is an attempt to A, identify harms done, B, make a statement about where we think we are, and C, create some commitments and milestones for by which these organizations can be held accountable. Because that's another thing that I think is relevant in terms of these matters, is it's one thing to say, yep, things are bad, right? And that's, again, newsflash, in other news, water is wet, right? There are systemic inequities that exist in the system. Okay. But what are we going to do about it? What are the metrics by which we're willing to be measured? And what are the equity investments that we are going to make in order to drive that change through, right? And then coming back, I mean, that's kind of what our forums are about. So we started this in April. So we're not a year later, but we're four sessions later. What have we done since then? Have we kept our word? Because that's an important part of this. You got to keep your word. So have we kept our word in terms of the things that we said we were going to do? And if an organization is serious about change, you put your word out there and you have people outside the organization check you.
Can I ask just a follow-up question to that? Because I found it so interesting what you mentioned earlier about Black History Month and how you're celebrating the recovery of, and this is new information for me, and shame on me for this, but of Malcolm X and Frederick Douglass. Like, how does that look in these forums? How are you celebrating those initiatives?
Well, with Frederick Douglass was an ardent abolitionist and an ardent temperance movement speaker, right? And part of the, again, don't get me started on James Baldwin, but another thing that happens with Black history is the parts of it that get told are the ones that are convenient and non-threatening. A lot of Frederick Douglass's temperance work was overshadowed by people, like I was just reading a transcript of a talk that he did where he gave a beautiful talk on temperance and the importance of moving alcohol out of the public space, but it was overshadowed by, because he in addition to that talk, he gave a talk on abolition, and his white counterparts at the talk decided that was not acceptable. So he basically got asked to leave. And just the, so that's one component. And Malcolm X had a path, his pathway to recovery was faith, right? I mean, he showed up in jail as an addict, and his pathway to recovery was Islam. And so, but that's not like, we don't typically, when we think of recovery heroes, we don't typically think of Malcolm X. Like, I don't see him like on posters in 12-step clubs, right? But he absolutely was, he was a shining example of a man who found recovery. And so I think in terms of we're doing that just to sort of give a different perspective. And I think the gentleman that's going to come and give the talk, Michael Johnson, is someone that really, he really is thought provoking in that he helped me he reminded me of something in one of his talks where he was talking about ethos, right? And the ethos of the Black man in America. And I'll just go on a short aside on this. I grew up in Texas, and I spent time with my mom is a psychologist and was in school at University of Texas. So I spent some time with my grandparents in Waco. And Waco in the 70s was kind of a throwback. It was a throwback to segregation. And there really was a Black community and a white community. And the Black community that I spent time around was Black-owned businesses. Black people kept to themselves, but the people that I saw were business owners and upstanding members of the community. And the reason I'm talking about this is, so my ethos of what Black men were and Black culture was very different than just a few years later in kind of sort of common, the image of the hustler and the pimp. And that Black male culture showed up in the late 70s and early 80s. That was completely divorced from what I grew up with, right? And this gentleman, Michael Johnson, does a wonderful job of talking about how somehow that shifted, right? What was present for him in the 60s in Detroit was the same thing that I saw. And it just kind of made me think about legacies and legacies of culture and how you sort of grow up to emulate what you've seen. And so we thought it was important to talk about recovery legacies in frames that people aren't used to hearing about them. So that's how I got to there. And I know that was a long way to get there, but it really did make me think about like why Malcolm X, and I know that Malcolm X was not a member of a 12-step community, but how I could see how it would be heresy to even have a picture of him in a 12-step club.
No, I love that. I think that's so important for the community. And particularly when we talk about communities of color, there may be different pathways, and a lot of times it may be spiritual. So I think that's really powerful what you're doing, and I thank you for sharing that. I think that would be of interest to our audience.
One last thought on that, and just that the business of Black History Month, and I am absolutely a fan of Black history. I was raised with embarrassment of riches in terms of knowing my history and knowing where I came from and knowing about Black people in America and before America and knowing about Black people on the continent. But I think that sometimes with Black history, it gets to be, especially in the business realm, performative. And one thing that we are absolutely not doing at my organization is we're not going to do that. We're not going to throw up a picture of MLK and, you know, say, great, hey, here's the Black history, off we go. We are working on, we're doing some legislative priority work around Black and Indigenous people of color. We've embedded it in our mission, and we are doing this forum and doing this North Star document as a contribution to Black future, right? So I'm interested in Black history, but I think the most compelling commitment we can make to Black history is an investment in Black future.
Now that's a quotable quote, Phil. I love that. I'm writing that down. That's amazing. Moving on to the next question, Phil, there's no question that this work can be physically, emotionally, and spiritually taxing. So what keeps you motivated?
In the allies that I have worked with, I have seen movement, right? And it is the movement in the allies that I have worked with that has given me hope. And, you know, I sometimes, you know, I've got a fairly strong supportive family structure. I've got a strong 12-step support structure around me. So they also give me support. But I think if I were to, maybe it's just about the people that I'm running into contact with, but I feel like there is a possibility for change. And the funny part is, a lot of people might describe me as a pessimist, but I have some optimism around this. And I think that given opportunity and some education, I think that we can get where we need to get. I think it will take time, right? I don't have rose-tinted glasses on. I don't think that next week, next month, next year, we will have solved systemic racism. I think that a problem that has been growing for 500 years will not be fixed in a year of marches and clever Super Bowl commercials and all of that stuff. But I have seen a willingness from some of the allies that I've worked with that I have not seen before. And it gives me some measure of hope. And I try to remember that, because I've also seen some things that make me shake my head and think of my grandparents and my great grandparents and some of the stuff that they've seen. And a lot of times they weren't very hopeful. So I balance it with that, but just in general, I think, as I look ahead and deal with younger people, that's where my hope comes from.
That's great, Bill. And I definitely would see you, having worked with you on this committee, in this time, that more of a realist, and that realism, is what keeps us moving forward, so because we have to address what it is, back to what Tanya said about a thing being the thing. And then we move forward with hope and knowing that we can create some change. So with that being said, we like to end this by thinking about an empowerment quote. What's your empowerment quote, and what's your empowerment song?
I say it a lot to people, and I hate to give a disclaimer on it, right? But on some days it makes perfect sense to me, and I say this to people to give them hope. But the whole arc of morality is long, but it bends towards justice. Mm-hmm. Like I do believe that. Some days that arc seems a lot longer than others, right? So, but I do ultimately believe that. And I gotta go with Fight the Power for my song. I'm a kid of the 80s, so Public Enemy is that's my jam. So I like that. The Fight the Power song always gets me going.
Thank you so much. You talked about creating a legacy of culture, and you're certainly leaving your footprints, your mark, and your legacy on this field as a whole.
Thanks so much, Phil. This has been an absolute pleasure to do this with you.
Excellent. I appreciate the opportunity.
This is Chelsea Cusimano with NAATP, and I want to tell you about Web Consults. Web Consults is a digital marketing agency that understands addiction treatment. They're effective and ROI focused. Their mission, to expand your impact by reaching new audiences. Visit webconsults.com or their link in our podcast notes to take advantage of special pricing for NAATP members.
What a great interview.
That was good. When he said the Malcolm X thing, like, I had a follow up with that. Like, that was just too powerful. And that is recovery in a lens I've never thought of it. I knew Malcolm X was in recovery from the book, the movie. In our world, it's 12-step or nothing. And I think that was really important for him to say you could get recovery, there the many pathways. So I thought that was really important, because I think that's going to be a big issue as we go forward in treating communities of color.
Absolutely. And it actually tied back to what he was saying in the beginning, which was that, in 12-step recovery, we just talk about recovery, but people of color don't have that privilege necessarily, because there's so many intersectional things going on that we just can't talk about that. And so when you look at someone like Malcolm X, there are so many different pieces to that story, so many layers to that history, but many parts get washed out, either out of comfort, out of just wanting to focus on one thing. And there's so many pieces to that story, including being a shining example of recovery, like Phil said. One of the things that Phil said that I love is about like the ethos of what Black men and culture looks like. So he grew up seeing Black businessmen, seeing very successful business owners versus in the 80s, things shifted and that you know, Black male culture you saw on TV was more about the pimp or, you know, just something very different. So it just goes back to how we emulate, our behavior emulates what we see. And Phil even started the interview saying, you know, entering recovery, there weren't a lot of people that looked like him. There weren't a lot of people that looked like us. And so what does that mean for our recovery? You know, how does that impact our recovery? I think it impacts it greatly when we are absent from the rooms, from the seats, from the staff.
You know, recovery is so, it's about like strength, hope, and experience, right? So you're in a room with people that can't share your experiences. For lots of men and women of color, you know, so that's, I think with the work that Phil's doing in his organization and what he mentioned that he has up and coming with North Star, I think we'll see a lot of intentional action towards creating spaces where people can really have shared experiences. I'm excited to see that work come about.
Me too. Especially around, you know, he talked a lot about equity investment. What is our investment in this work? What are the metrics that we are going to measure ourselves against? You know, in this field, we talk a lot about outcomes and abstinence rates. And of course, we need to do that. But what are our DEI investments and metrics? And, you know, I started off celebrating Phil for being the first African-American board member of NAACP, and I still want to celebrate him, but I don't want to celebrate the fact that it took 40 plus years for us to get here. And that's sort of a call to action because many of us have boards of directors, we're nonprofits, or we certainly have leadership, all of us. And, you know, I think it's time to take a hard, it's well past time to take a hard look at the reflection of what our leadership looks like, and does it reflect the population we serve, and does it reflect America in general?
Yeah, absolutely. And where the need is, you know, and like, you know, what he was referencing about the pandemic and this real exposure of the disparity in treatment from the healthcare, you know, to mental health and substance abuse. I mean, it can't be ignored anymore. And I so appreciate that a 40-year-old institution can be really introspective about that and say, okay, well, we need to take a look at it ourselves. And, you know, we're part of this committee, you know, we're having these really open and raw conversations about what that means. And I think it's something definitely to be honored and celebrated, but knowing that there's a lot of work that still has to be done, you know, it's not just a token gesture, you know, as Phil, as the first Black board member, that, you know, we have a lot of initiatives in the pipeline, but it's going to take a lot of work, you know, and some of it hard. We've already had, you know, some uncomfortable conversations about this because these are the first time these conversations are happening. So, you know, it's definitely a process.
Absolutely. And it takes a village. It takes allies, you know, like Phil mentioned a couple of the organizations they work with, including White Bison. We're going to be having Kateri on this podcast in a little bit. So yeah, it takes allies and it takes a village. So I encourage everybody listening to this podcast to consider how they can, you know, join the fight.
Yeah, agreed. You know, and it's Black History Month. And I think Phil, you know, made it's really clear that Black History Month shouldn't be celebrated in a matter where it's a PR, you know, it's good for PR. It's really, what's the intentionality of Black History Month? You know, what do we need? It's more action-based. Tanya, I love sharing this space with you. And I'm so grateful, like, we can keep having these conversations on this podcast and look forward to future ones.
Oh, me too. I can't wait. You know, I don't get up at 6 a.m. for much, but this I'm happily getting out of bed for. So.
If our listeners want to learn more about NATAP's diversity, equity, and inclusivity initiatives, they can visit natap.org/resources/DEI.